journalism is to question the prevailing wisdom. Question the prevailing wisdom.
Just speak the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
All rights reserved and affirmed.
We are all minds. These are weapons of mass dissent.
These are weapons of mass dissent.
Welcome to Uprising, a daily digest of independent news analysis, investigation, education, artistic expression, and activism. It's Wednesday, January 30th, 2008, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar.
It just makes me stop and think. Silence is not an option.
An in-depth look at the real legacy of Indonesian dictator Suharto. A conversation with award-winning filmmaker Alex Gibney about his Oscar-nominated Taxi to the Dark Side. And local activists struggle to save Eco Village from the LAUSD. This is Uprising. Good morning and welcome to Uprising. Indonesia's longtime former dictator Muhammad Suharto is dead at the age of 86. He was given a state funeral yesterday with full military honors. Suharto ruled Indonesia with an iron fist for 32 years before being overthrown in an uprising sparked by the Asian financial crisis in 1998. In speaking at his funeral, current Indonesian President Susilo Bambang Yudhoyono dismissed Suharto's bloody legacy, saying he, quote, made mistakes because no one is perfect. Suharto came to power in a U.S.-backed coup in 1965 and stands accused of committing genocide. The U.S. Embassy in Jakarta supplied Suharto with a list of Indonesian Communist Party members. Between 500,000 and 3 million people vanished in the several months after the coup. Despite some praise for improving Indonesia's economy, Suharto was also accused of extreme corruption. According to the UN and World Bank, he embezzled an estimated $15 to $35 billion in state funds. 9 years after Suharto was ousted, Indonesia's government remains one of the most corrupt in the world. Today, we'll take an in-depth look at the legacy of Suharto with my guest, John Miller. He is the National Coordinator for the East Timor and Indonesia Action Network. Welcome to Uprising, John.
Thank you for having me.
John, tell us the story of exactly how Suharto came to power in 1965 and what specifically was the U.S. role and what happened in the months following.
Suharto was the commander of the troops within Jakarta, the capital, and six generals were murdered in October, if I remember, October 1965. Suharto was not targeted. His role in the alleged coup, who was behind the coup, are all still shrouded somewhat in mystery. Suharto mobilized his troops, blamed the Communist Party of Indonesia, which was the third largest Communist Party in the world and probably the largest legal party in Indonesia and an ally of then President Sukarno, the founding president of Indonesia. And in the aftermath of that, Suharto and his troops, others, engaged in a killing spree. As you said, most estimates are 500,000 to 1 million people killed in the months following Suharto's takeover. Not just Communist Party members of groups that may or may not have been associated with the Communist Party, local people taking revenge with military and police permission. Most of the killing was in Bali and in Java, which is where the capital is located.
I understand that the manner of the coup in which Suharto took power was considered a model for the U.S.-backed coup in Chile 7 years later that ousted Salvador Allende, and that it was really looked at by the CIA as this sort of ideal situation to orchestrate regime change.
Well, Sukarno was not a friend of the U.S. He was the founding president of Indonesia, a founder of the non-aligned movement, which peculiarly Suharto then took his place as, as Indonesia considered one of the founding members, hosting non-aligned movement conferences over the years. but was and was very much a critic of the U.S., not very friendly to U.S. business interests, had withdrawn Indonesia from the U.N., and Suharto was definitely very friendly to the U.S., was willing to allow a lot of U.S. corporate investment, particularly in the oil and mining industries, you know, as long as his family and his cronies got their share, and paid for military protection, then, you know, he was perfectly happy to welcome U.S. businesses on those terms, and had in the height of the Cold War achieved what was seen as this great victory over communism, and that was celebrated in places like Time magazine and the New York Times, in official circles in Washington, even as some of those statements acknowledged the bloodbath that was taking place.
Now, you said that the actual backers of the coup were—it's still shrouded in mystery exactly, you know, whether there was any foreign involvement. But certainly, the U.S. Supported the coup, even if it may not necessarily have orchestrated it. Although there's certainly suspicion.
Yeah, and it's not even that clear who was behind the original killing of the generals who mm-hmm. were. According to my understanding, we're actually on the progressive side. So it, in some ways, doesn't make sense that the Communist Party or members of the Communist Party would have been involved. And certainly as an organization, the Communist Party wasn't prepared to take advantage of the situation. But regardless of who did the coup and who, whether they had foreign backing or not or for what purpose, the counter coup by Suharto clearly was welcomed by the U.S., and as you noted in your introduction, documents classified and investigative journalism done years later showed that the U.S. had a list of key Communist Party members, that they supplied that to the Indonesian military, and then would check off the names as those people were arrested and killed.
Hmm. Now, in addition to members of the Communist Party, you said, you know, there were a lot of others, teachers and artists, and just any kind of cultural expression was silenced.
Indonesia, one of the world's premier novelists, Pramoedya, was imprisoned on Buru Island under very harsh conditions for, I think, about just under 20 years, actually wrote his, you know, what are considered his finest novels. They're called the Buru Quartet, and are about the resistance to Dutch colonialism and the changes in Indonesian society during that struggle. He actually, those were told that to his fellow prisoners, would sometimes write down sections on scrap that would be smuggled out, but wasn't able to actually type it up until he was released and the books could be published. But most of those that were killed were actually just peasants that belonged to peasants' associations and co-ops that may, you know, in some cases, had support from groups allied with the Communist Party or willing to work with them. And, you know, in other cases, you know, were just victims of people taking advantage of the times, including within the military, of land disputes and land grabs.
So Suharto came to power with a mass murder of Indonesians, and then there were the East Timorese. I'm speaking with John Miller, National Coordinator for the East Timor and Indonesia Action Network. In reading the mainstream press, John, there is generally not much mention of East Timor. In 1975, Suharto made his entrance to that island. Tell our listeners what happened there and how significant is East Timor to Suharto's legacy?
East Timor was a Portuguese colony. Indonesia had made no formal claim on it when Indonesia was created out of the former Dutch colonies in the region, and there had been a controversial takeover of West Papua, which was not part of the original Indonesia when it was granted independence, which Suharto, as a military person, was involved in the 60s, and certainly after he took power, consolidated his rule with the death toll estimated at 100,000. That still goes on. East Timor was in 1974-75. Portugal had had its own revolution, overthrowing its dictatorship, and its colonies were all moving towards independence. And in East Timor, there were parties that favored staying associated with Portugal, looking for a leftist-identified party, Fretilin, looking for immediate independence, some smaller groups wanting to become part of Indonesia. And Suharto was actually, according to most of the record, ambivalent about invading and seizing East Timor outright, as were the Australia and the U.S., who Indonesia was consulting about this, because Indonesia feared it would upset relations with those in other countries, that their arms and weapons supply and military training would be cut off as required by U.S. law. On December 6, 1975, President Ford and Secretary of State Kissinger made a stopover in Jakarta, and there's a transcript of the meeting. They gave permission, said, "Don't worry, you know, we'll pretend we're cutting off your weapons, and then we'll just renew them a few months later. Just, you know, blame it on the communists." And Indonesia invaded the next day, you know, basically after Ford and Kissinger left Indonesian airspace, which was their request, don't do it while we're here.
Right.
In the aftermath of that invasion, primarily in the first 5 or 6 years, estimated 100,000 to 200,000 East Timorese died, both in military action and in war-induced starvation.
And that was a third of the population, is that right?
Yeah, up to a third. The population at that time was probably about 650,000 or so.
John, how much did the West prop up Suharto's regime? Could he have ruled Indonesia and carried out his atrocities in East Timor for so long, if not for Western support?
Well, to me, one of the telling statistics is 90% of the weapons used, and these are U.S. government estimates, in the invasion in East Timor came from the U.S. If the U.S. had said no to the invasion, probably if Australia had said no, and they were actually more enthusiastic and backers of the invasion in its immediate aftermath, I don't think Suharto would have invaded.
What about just remaining in power in general in Indonesia itself? I mean, Indonesia is a very vast archipelago of islands. It's, you know, thousands of little islands. It's not easy for a single dictator to keep power over these islands. For 32 years he ruled. I mean, could he have done it without Western support?
No, in the sense, one, he ruled by fear, and that was fear he generated and his military generated in the aftermath. There were massacres within Indonesia after 65, 66, but not that many were needed to keep control of the population. But you know, the weapons and training for his military and police, for his repressive apparatus, intelligence agencies, came from the U.S., came from the West.
Right.
And the money, you know, the other way he ruled was through bribery and corruption. So those that worked with him did his bidding, you know, got a piece of the action, and a lot of that money came either in the form of corporate payoffs or international aid from institutions like the IMF and World Bank. And there's, you know, in the few years before his fall, you know, people were uncovering, you know, internal World Bank memos describing, yes, we know about the corruption, we know how much is being skimmed off this project or that project, but, you know, we're not going to raise it either publicly or even privately with Suharto.
John,
and that great wealth continues to protected him and his retirement and protects, you know, his cronies and his military, you know, because the Indonesian judiciary is very easy to bribe.
What do you make of the praise being heaped on Suharto after his death in the mainstream media for lifting up Indonesia's economy? I mean, if there's anything that you're reading in favor of Suharto, it's his role in modernizing Indonesia and enriching the middle class, if you will.
Well, when he seized power, Indonesia was an economic mess by most every measure. So given how low his starting point was, yes, things improved for some. But compared to, say, Malaysia, a similar economy, not, of course not as large, Malaysia, and with many fewer natural resources to exploit. You know, Malaysia during that period did far better without the kind of brutality that Suharto engaged in. And we shouldn't forget the reason Suharto was finally forced from power was the economy essentially collapsed in the Asian financial crisis in a way. Other Asian economies that were affected by that crisis certainly suffered, but not to the degree Indonesia did. So this economic prosperity that he generated or was said to generate was largely a house of cards and benefited only a few. And third, one just imagine if there wasn't that degree of corruption, if every corporation wanting to do business, local or international, didn't have to pay a big percentage off to Suharto's family and friends. If even an ordinary Indonesian wanting to just move goods from one town to another didn't have to pay a police or military bribe at some post along the way, how much better Indonesia's economy would have done. And finally, Saddam Hussein improved the Iraqi economy, certainly up until the invasion of Kuwait.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't and shouldn't have seen obituaries saying that somehow excused his killing and repression and massacres of the Kurds.
Now, so why was Suharto never tried for war crimes? I mean, we saw so many international efforts around Pinochet, around now Fujimori, around the former Liberian dictator. Why not Suharto? Why did he escape this? And why was he allowed to sort of live out his retirement in peace?
No efforts were made in Indonesia to charge him with human rights crimes, war crimes. There were some efforts to charge him for corruption, which I think tells you which the current elite in Indonesia values more, money over lives. There were some half-hearted efforts to have some prosecutions over some human rights crimes, but never got very far and never went very high up the chain of command. And certainly only beginning efforts to deal with the great tragedy of 1965 in terms of debates over how to portray it in textbooks, and that's still very much contested. But every time they would try to bring him into court on some of these corruption charges, like many a dictator, he'd have a bunch of doctors come in and say he's ill. And in fact, this recent round of illness, and I assume it's coincidental, came as that effort was being revived, actually just to bring him into civil court to retrieve assets stolen from foundations. Some of his children have been tried. One went to jail for actually arranging the murder of a judge that had convicted him on corruption, and a few of his cronies. But those in power now very much owe their careers, and many of them their base of power, to him. Indonesia's president, who came to power as a reformer and did try to institute some reforms, is a former general, served in East Timor, and owes his career to Suharto. Many of the judges, prosecutors as well, or either that or are afraid of what he and his family could have while he was alive and can still do for those that have still remain from that.
So essentially Suharto's legacy remains alive in Indonesia, unfortunately.
Now, and from what I've seen and heard, as mixed as the Western press has been about his legacy, the Indonesian press, or much of it, particularly television, was wholly glowing.
And, well, John,
and his former ministers are in there saying, "Oh, he made some mistakes at the end."
Right, right.
They don't even want to discuss the beginning in 1965.
Right. Well, John, unfortunately, we're out of time. I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
Okay. thank you very much for having me. And you know, people can find out more on our website, which is etan.org.
ETAN.org. John Miller is the National Coordinator for the East Timor and Indonesia Action Network. ETAN.org is their website. You are listening to Uprising. Later in the hour, we'll be joined by a couple of local activists to tell us why Eco Village is being threatened by the LAUSD. And after this radical day in history and our weekly contest, Who Said That?, we will have a conversation with Alex Gibney about his Oscar-nominated documentary. Stay tuned.
Listening to the Morning Review, Uprising Style with Sonali Kohatkar. We'll be right back in one moment, but join hosts Christine Kings and Lynn Ballin tonight on Feminist Magazine. They'll be giving away tickets for the play The Golden State, also conducting part 5 of a class action workshop series. They'll be speaking with Jehan Nujam, the gutsy director of The Control Room and creator Panje Day. That's tonight at 7 here on Radio Powered by the People. Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman is coming up at 9. Keep it tuned right here.
The internationally acclaimed exhibit, Not Enough Space, features the artwork of two Puerto Rican political prisoners, artists, and community organizers, Oscar Lopez Rivera and Carlos Alberto Torres. The opening ceremony will take place at Casa de la Raza on February 1st at 6 p.m. Casa de la Raza is located at 601 East Montecito Street in Santa Barbara, California. Adolfo Matos is a special speaker for the opening ceremony who will be talking about the joining of art and activism in the struggles for Puerto Rican liberation. This event is co-sponsored by KPFK, and more information about the radio station can be found at www.kpfk.org.
This is your Radio Roots reporter, Navi Sandhu. On this day, January 30th, in 1917, the first jazz record was made. Jazz is rooted in the African-American experience in this country, and early jazz is a direct product of working-class New Orleans musicians. But this first jazz recording was cut by a group of middle-class white men called the Dixieland Jazz Band. Many early jazz recordings were made by white men, some of whom performed in blackface. The first jazz recordings by black musicians were made later that year. Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you, never let the past slip away.
And now we come to the special feature of our program.
Who said that? Who said that?
Where is it?
So what do you call yourself, huh? Como se llama?
I can't hear you.
Who are you?
What's your name, dude?
Who the hell are you?
I really don't know.
If it's anybody, it's me.
Who?
Who?
Who is this?
Come on, come on.
Seems as though I've heard that before.
And before we go to our next story, we'll go to this week's edition of Who Said That?, a weekly contest in collaboration with the Pacifica Radio Archives. Each week, we'll play you a short soundbite from the vault of the archives and ask you to tell us who said that. All you have to do is call in and identify the voice, and we'll send you the CD from the Pacifica Radio Archives that featured the clip you just heard. So let's take a listen to this week's mystery speaker.
So I do moralize, and I tell people is don't kill. Don't kill even in self-defense. Don't work on killing machines. Is don't litter and don't take more than you need. And know you are going to die and think about it.
If you can guess who that is, call us at 818-985-5735 with the correct answer. That's 818-985-KPFK. Soon after the American defeat of the Taliban regime in Afghanistan, a young Afghan taxi driver named Dilawar was arrested by pro-U.S. Afghan militias and imprisoned at Bagram Air Base. We'll take a listen today to a conversation with Alex Gibney, who made a film about this young man and the legacy of torture surrounding it. In the 5 days before the Lawar died, he was subjected to cruel, unusual, and degrading punishment and became perhaps the first victim of torture in the U.S.'s war on terror. Alex Gibney is an award-winning director. He made Enron the smartest guys in the room, and he now brings us this new documentary. It's called Taxi to the Dark Side, focusing on the protocol of torture and cruel interrogation techniques used by the U.S. military in Bagram, Afghanistan, Abu Ghraib, Iraq, and Guantanamo, Cuba. Taxi to the Dark Side was just nominated for an Academy Award for Best Documentary and opens in select theaters nationwide throughout this month and next. And I spoke last Friday, with Alex Gibney about the film. Well, first, congratulations on the nomination.
Oh, thank you.
The documentary is, I think, in watching it, extremely essential and extremely disturbing. You feature in the documentary all of the photographs that we saw coming out of Abu Ghraib and more. They were uncensored. There were videos, too. Where did you get all of this information, first of all?
Some of it comes from various sources, sometimes from soldiers, sometimes from lawyers, sometimes from other sources. And in addition to the Abu Ghraib photos and cell phone camera footage, we've also obtained some of the first footage ever from the Bagram prison.
Hmm. And Bagram was where this Afghan man, the Lawar, was killed. And it was admitted by the U.S. Army that he was basically died as a result of homicide. Why did you choose the story of this man to tell the torture, tell us the story of the U.S.'s torture techniques?
Well, there are a number of reasons. First of all, he was a pure innocent. I mean, this was a kid, really. I mean, I think he was 23 years old when he was killed. He'd never spent a night away from home. He left behind a wife and a very young daughter. But also, a number of things disturbed me about it. And the article that I originally saw that led me to Dilawar was written by Tim Golden of the New York Times. And in the last paragraph of the article, one of the people he interviewed remarked that after day three of a five-day interrogation, they concluded that he was completely innocent. But they tortured him for another 2 days. So it was the momentum of torture, I think, that was interesting to me. And the last thing was that the people who interrogated Dilawar were then sent from a Bagram to Abu Ghraib. So it showed the connection that this is not a bad apple story. And also the three people who rode in his taxi were sent to Guantanamo for no reason, presumably, other than to cover up the fact that military personnel had killed an innocent man in Bagram. So by looking at the Dilawar case, you could see how it all fit together, that it was not an isolated incident. Indeed, it was an act of policy by the Bush administration.
Now, you talked to the soldiers who were involved, in particular, Willie Brand was one of them. What was their sense of what they did and what happened?
Well, it was peculiar, and I can tell you that when I initially was able to interview them, I did not look at them sympathetically at all. These were people who had actually, collectively killed a man in their custody, somebody who, had no weapons. It was shackled. But at the same time, they were clearly haunted by what they had done, and they had felt that they were either encouraged or explicitly ordered to do what they had done, and they didn't understand why they were being punished and why their superior officers weren't even being investigated, much less indicted. And also, they told me that routinely very, very, very high-ranking people would come through the Bagram prison and would see prisoners shackled overhead, beaten, and other things, hooded. These things were not part of traditional American military procedure, but it was clearly condoned by very high-ranking officials. So I think they felt scapegoated.
And New York Times writer Carlotta Gall, in the film, she shows her interview of a high-ranking official who says that he was not aware that there were ever shackles used from the ceiling and that sort of thing.
And that's clearly just false. Mm-hmm. I mean, there were a number of lies that came out of Bagram. I mean, you mentioned that that it was that the army said that Dilawar's death was a homicide. Yes, it did, but it took a long time for that to come out. Initially, the army said he died of natural causes. Now it was Carlotta Gall and her rather heroic effort to go up and see this Afghan family. She discovered that along with the body, they had a death certificate. And it was on that death certificate that that an impressive army coroner had said that the cause of death was homicide. And because of Carlotta's investigation, the Dilawar case began to be opened up.
I remember that very, very detailed series of articles in the New York Times that came out about not only Dilawar, but another Afghan man, Habibullah, describing in excruciating detail what was done to these men. Let's hear an excerpt from the documentary Taxi to the Dark Side, which is done by filmmaker Alex Gibney. Again, the film was just nominated for an Academy Award for Best Documentary, and this clip also focuses on the Afghan man, Dilawar, who was killed in Bagram.
Throughout the investigation and even in the trials, a lot of the guards and interrogators described Dilawar as a very combative detainee, as a tough character, and that's just never been reconciled with all the other evidence that there was about this guy. He weighed 122 pounds when he died.
The men who had been passengers in Dilawar's taxi told us later that he had just been absolutely terrified at Bagram, that they heard him through the walls of the isolation cells screaming for his mother and father.
He'd been in a very uncomfortable position, muttering things, sometimes praying, sometimes asking for help, or seemingly asking for help, because I couldn't understand his language.
A number of witnesses remember the night before Dilawar died.
But just that one night, he got kicked in the leg, maybe like 10 times.
Some of the soldiers said they started using the knee strikes essentially to shut him up because he was yelling and screaming.
The damage that was done from multiple strikes, and a lot of that could have been avoided had you known the person before you had fought with them and used that exact technique.
When they eventually came to take him to an isolation cell, I believe his body had become almost limp. One of the reasons why they began punching him was that they felt that he was putting it on. He was in the airlock, standing there with a hood over his head. He had his hands tied above his head, and he was moaning.
That's the voice of Muazzam Beg, one of the detainees actually at Guantanamo, describing Dilawar and what was done to him, the Afghan man who was perhaps the first victim of torture in the U.S.'s war on terror. That was an excerpt from the documentary Taxi to the Dark Side. Alex Gibney, the filmmaker, joins me in studio. And so this story of this one man really opens up the whole can of worms about how these methods of torture have become so commonplace now in the U.S. Army, U.S. military in general. Can you talk about the role of Dick Cheney in particular and Rumsfeld, and the fact that there really were no written guidelines, that a lot of these rank-and-file soldiers had to sort of make it up as they went along?
Well, I think what happened, the film is called Taxi to the Dark Side, and Dark Side refers to a quote from Vice President Dick Cheney about a week after 9/11, where he told Tim Russert on Meet the Press, "We're now going to have to go over to the dark side." And he meant a lot of things by that. In particular, he meant actually explicit new guidelines for the CIA that permitted the CIA to do things like waterboarding and others. But also, it was a conscious attempt within, through Dick Cheney's office and also through the Office of Legal Counsel in the Department of Justice, to try to undo some of the rules and regulations that had formerly been guidelines for military personnel in the field. At the same time they removed those guidelines, they also exerted tremendous pressure on soldiers to get information. So that was a kind of fog of ambiguity along with this pressure that caused soldiers to, essentially leave any bonds of morality behind. It's also important, though, to note that Donald Rumsfeld had given explicit authorization for extreme and cruel techniques to be used on certain detainees at Guantanamo. Those were written orders. Together, those techniques were certainly tantamount to torture. But what happened was, and the way this stuff spreads like a virus that mutates and migrates is, you know, when soldiers in Bagram heard that soldiers in Guantanamo had permission to do some of these things, explicit permission from Rumsfeld, who was, you know, looking in on the interrogation almost on a daily basis, they then started to use them themselves in a kind of a peculiar can-do fashion. It was as if the civilian administration was giving a wink and a nod to the entire, you know, to every aspect of the military and saying, go for it. The gloves are off. That was an expression that was often used many, many, many times. Or as some of the soldiers at Bagram were told by their superior officers, it's time to take these detainees out of their comfort zone.
Tell us what was done to Mohammed al-Qahtani. And first, remind our listeners who he was. He seems to have suffered perhaps the worst, at least documented, case of torture.
Yeah, I'm not sure it's the worst. I mean, after all, Dilawar died, and we know about Dilawar, and there were a number of other detainees who were actually killed in detention and classified as homicides by the military. But Mohammed al-Qahtani is an interesting case. He was, we think, the 20th hijacker. And he arrived in Guantanamo without us really knowing who he was. It was discovered that he may have been the 20th hijacker while he was at Guantanamo. And they Donald Rumsfeld approved a special interrogation plan for Qahtani, and then later one other person named Slahi. And these interrogation procedures are cataloged in a 65-page interrogation log, which we obtained. And these are extremely extreme procedures, but also increasingly bizarre procedures. He was stripped at times. He was subjected to extremes of heat and cold. At one point, he was forcibly hydrated. He was forced to urinate in his pants. He had to be taken to the hospital because his heart rate had slowed so extremely. So this is a guy who was unquestionably tortured by intent and by order.
Now, the sleep deprivation went on for, 50 days?
I'm not remembering now exactly, but it was over a month. Mm. And initially, the rule was he would get 4 hours of sleep per night. But you saw after a week or so that it wasn't really 4 hours straight. Occasionally, they would let him sleep for 5 or 10 minutes and then resume the interrogation. They were pushing the envelope in every extreme way possible. And that's one thing that happens, I think, that most people don't realize. The reason that the military has rules and regulations about interrogations is that in the field, you know, there's a thing that the military knows about. It's called force drift. And if you push somebody and they're not giving you information, then you push them further and further and further and further until you've completely left the building. There's a kind of incremental process that goes on in which everybody or almost anybody can go over to the dark side, as Dick Cheney would have said, and push things further and further and further. I think we're capable of it. Many of us are. And that's why we have rules and regulations, because we don't want our armed forces to become a mob, in effect, or a lynch mob, more particularly.
I've been speaking with Alex Gibney, director of Taxi to the Dark Side, and Enron, the smartest guys in the room. To find out where you can watch Taxi to the Dark Side, it's opening in theaters throughout this month and next, you can visit the website taxitothedarkside.com. The film was just nominated for an Academy Award for Best Documentary. Again, it's taxitothedarkside.com. And before we go to a break and our last story for the day, I want to announce the winner of this week's Who Said That? It's Dr. John Calvin Jones, listening from North Carolina. So congratulations, Dr. Jones, and also very excited that one of our online listeners called in and won. And the correct answer is Kurt Vonnegut. That's right, we played Kurt Vonnegut. Kurt Vonnegut speaking at New York University on November 6, 1970. A legendary American writer, best known for his novel Slaughterhouse-Five. He died last April in Manhattan, and we'll send a copy of the CD, Kurt Vonnegut from the Vault, to our winner. Let's take another listen to the clip that we played.
So I do moralize, and I tell people is don't kill. Don't kill even in self-defense. Don't work on killing machines. Is don't litter and don't take more than you need. And know you are going to die and think about it.
Kurt Vonnegut. And for those of you who didn't win, you can order this excellent CD featuring this clip from the Pacifica Radio Archives by calling 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Tune in next week for another edition of Who Said That. After this short break, we'll find out about the LA Eco Village and why it's under threat. Welcome back to Uprising. Due to declining enrollment, the Los Angeles Unified School District has largely scaled back on expansion plans for new school sites. But despite this, residents and owners of properties in LA Eco Village were notified that their neighborhood may now be under threat. Unique to the city, LA Eco Village, located on the corner of First and Vermont, is one of the few urban-based communities based on ecological living in Southern California. The LAUSD has slated that site for a new school that would service up to 950 elementary schoolers. Concerned community members of LA Eco Village contend that the district need not put forth a choice between new schools and affordable housing. Earlier this month, hundreds of the community supporters turned out to an LAUSD meeting to encourage the board to consider alternative construction sites. Another meeting between LA Eco Village residents and LAUSD is planned. Joining me in studio this morning are two residents from LA Eco Village, Laura Morrison and Michelle Wong. Laura is also a KPFK volunteer and a familiar face around at the station. Welcome to Uprising, Laura.
Thank you.
And Michelle Wong is also, in addition to being a resident at LA Eco Village, she's a board member with the Beverly, Vermont Community Land Trust. Welcome, Michelle.
Thank you, Sonali.
First, let's talk about what LA Eco Village is for those of our listeners who have no idea, who have never heard of it.
Well, we're a diverse, intentional community that joins together to live a higher quality of life with a smaller environmental footprint. So we're doing that in a lot of different ways. We're learning about living in community, which is a lost art in this country, and we're learning to live with less stuff. Anyone who's recently seen the story of Stuff will appreciate what that's about. And we also are trying to live with less dependence on oil. So many of us live a car-free lifestyle or what we call a car-light lifestyle. So we concentrate on walkable living and using bikes and mass transit. We're also trying to grow food or buy food locally and use appropriate technologies to lessen our environmental footprint. Mm.
How long has LA Eco Village been around for, Michelle?
It's been intentional project for over 15 years. It started on White House Place in the front yard.
And that's where you live?
I live on White House Place, that's right. But it started with community members coming together, especially in the wake of the 92 uprisings, and deciding that, you know, we have to live differently in the urban core. We have to live differently in the cities because the environment after the uprisings was full of people who were scared, who didn't have trust in each other. And I think through very, very intentional actions, folks came together. They started a neighborhood watch program. They started coming out in the streets and having community dinners and getting to know each other and being more responsible for each other in everyday interactions.
So is it a combination of people who used to already live there and then people who've moved there over the last 15 years?
Absolutely, absolutely. We have folks who have been there for very many years, very, very many years. We have elderly who've been there, some of them have been there for over 30 years. Mm. So it's a really great mix of folks. We have Vietnamese families, Korean families, Latino extended families with young children, as well as a number of elderly.
So let's talk about what LAUSD is now planning for this site. LAUSD, of course, has the power of eminent domain to take over properties and land to convert into schools. But I understand there's already an elementary school right adjacent to LA Eco Village. Lara?
Yes. What the LAUSD wants to do is to find a site for one of the mini schools that's on their building program. And they currently own about 1 acre of property on the north side of White House Place. And they've proposed taking out White House Place and all of the housing on the south side, plus going to the east and taking housing on Madison Avenue. And we think that there's a better way. They also own property north of Virgil Middle School, which is right across this street on the north side of First. And they could, we believe, create a great school in that area without taking any housing.
Tell us about the meeting that took place recently between LAUSD members and LA Eco Village. What happened?
Well, the meeting happened on January 9th. And we were able to garner about over 200 supporters of LA Eco Village and Madison neighborhoods. And we were very surprised that LAUSD only presented one possibility for siting this school, and that was on top of our homes.
And are there other possibilities?
Absolutely. This is why so many of us came out and wanted to speak about other possibilities.
What are they?
Well, just a little bit of background. There is a brand new elementary school that opened two blocks away. It's called Frank Del Olmo, and it houses 950 students. In addition, there are two other elementary schools about 15 blocks away that opened within the last 2 years. So the first question was to ask, you know, in the face of declining enrollments, what is the need for another school in our particular area? We've already lost 120 affordable units of housing to the new school that's on Vermont and First. And we also wanted to look at the possibilities of taking industrial areas that have been empty or are underutilized, and turning that property into schools.
Doesn't LAUSD own some parking lots in the area?
Absolutely. They acquired properties 20 years ago in north of Virgil Middle School that have been sitting empty, that are just being used as parking lots, and we really encouraged LAUSD to look at that.
What was their response?
Well, we'll see tonight. We're hoping that they come and tell us that this is, they've looked at it and they've found that it's a viable site. That's our hope.
So what's happening specifically tonight? There's another meeting planned, or is it just an LAUSD board meeting that you plan to attend?
No, this is a community outreach meeting, and the idea is that they would present hopefully more than one potential site, and their goal is to have a recommendation, the facilities people, to have a recommendation to the LAUSD board. And our goal is that it not be our homes. We want them to choose another site as the preferred site, and we think this option that involves the parking lots north of Virgil is very promising.
There are several sort of battles that have been fought with LAUSD and various communities over just this issue. I remember we had on Uprising, I believe it was last year, a guest from Van Nuys who was struggling to save his neighborhood from LAUSD, former programmer at KPFK, Marcos Villatoro McPeak, and he came and talked about how historic and important and close-knit his community was, and it was being threatened as well. What is, what's going on here with LAUSD? They closed down, they've canceled plans for 19 new schools. Clearly, they're in trouble in terms of enrollment, and yet they're looking at erasing an existing community.
Well, right now, it's easier the way that the rules are set up, it's easier for LAUSD to take housing than it is to acquire commercial space.
Why is
that? Well, I don't know the history of that, but I think that's one of the things that needs to be changed. Another thing is that there are limitations on how high they can build that I think we really should revise in terms of what happens in L.A. because the land values are so high. And there's also restrictions on the bond money for use in refurbishing existing schools to meet the needs for additional students. And that I think that needs to be changed as well. I mean, there still is overcrowding, but I think that it's kind of like the deck is stacked against neighborhoods
right.
in terms of meeting the needs.
So the longer-term issue is to address the rules itself of how LAUSD acquires property. So give our listeners some information on tonight for people who are interested in supporting LA Eco Village. Are there numbers or that they can call, et cetera?
Well, we're specifically here today to tell people, KPFK listeners, to please come to the community meeting and voice your support. It's going to be at Frank Del Olmo Elementary School, which is at 100 North New Hampshire, and that's on the corner of Vermont and First. It's one block west of the LA Eco Village, and it's just a couple blocks south of the Beverly Vermont Metro Station. So
that's 100 North New Hampshire.
Yes.
What time tonight?
6 p.m. 6 p.m. And we're going to be setting up a table so folks can sign in on our petition as well and receive a little bit more information about the LA Eco Village.
And for folks who may not be able to attend?
There's an online petition, and we also are asking people to write letters of support for our keeping our neighborhood intact
to the
LAUSD board.
And what's the website?
It's www.laecovillage.org. Again, that's laecovillage.org.
laecovillage.org. My guests have been Lara Morrison and Michelle Wong, both residents of LA Eco Village. Lara is also a KPFK volunteer. Michelle also sits on the board of Beverly Vermont Community Land Trust. I want to thank the two of you very much for joining us today and also wish you good luck in your struggle.
Thank you, Somali.
You are listening to Uprising. And before we close the show, I want to remind our listeners that our next fund drive begins on February 12th through the 26th. And it's always a time when we come to you for our support, for supporting this station. If you missed KPFK this past weekend because we were off the air due to the icy weather on Mount Wilson where our transmitter is, then think about what KPFK means to you. We really need your support, both in terms of contributions as well as volunteers, particularly during the morning shift. So if you want to volunteer with KPFK, call us at 818-985-2711, extension 513, or visit kpfk.org. For Sonali Subversive Thought for the Day, I'd like to quote conservationist Aldo Leopold, who once said, "We abuse land because we regard it as a commodity belonging to us. When we see land as a community to which we belong, we may begin to use it with love and respect." That's Aldo Leopold, and that's Sonali Subversive Thought for the Day. You've been listening to Uprising. Gabriel San Roman is our assistant producer. Teddy Robinson is our engineer. Special thanks to Alan Minsky for help with today's show. You can hear an audio stream of today's program after 10 a.m. on our website, uprisingradio.org. Our email is mail@uprisingradio.org. CDs of the show are available at pacificaradioarchives.org or by calling 1-800-735-0230. I'm your host and producer, Sonali Kolhatkar. Thanks so much for listening.